Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. A new way to make the mind go quiet is get up on a seat and try and think of something wise to say. Noticing in the chanting this evening, we have this refrain. We've been doing it for many, many years. There's asking forgiveness, Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, saying whatever actions by body, speech, or mind have been careless or heedless, may these be accepted. I can, in future, practice with restraint regarding the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. A kind of action of acknowledging the times when one looks back, we feel have really been very clear or agile or dispassionate or compassionate or spacious or whatever. So a sense of restraint. Check the reactions. Whereas we get reactive and act or think or speak in reactive ways. Acknowledging the kind of where we can just keep digging these old habits, right? Just keep digging ruts and doing the same thing over and over again through reactions, because reactions are just that, they're not actions, they're reactions, they're things one does again and again and again. So there's this kind of treadmill quality about it that makes it one feel so helpless sometimes. Doing this again, he did it again. That's reaction. In a way, we are trying to cultivate right action, skillful karma, rather than reaction, which is just bringing up or reacting in the same ways. Where we get compulsive or squeezed or fiery or depressed or whatever it is, you find yourself going down these same channels again, these same tracks again. In that, then we can feel very much, oh, this is me, this is the kind of bedrock of what I am. So that's quite a depressing kind of view. And so when we recognize this in terms of practice, say this is something that's our common problem. It's not a statement of what we are, but it's a statement of what happens. What happens, because it's what happens, it's something that also could not happen. So the first sense, this is what restraint is about, is checking something from happening. This doesn't always go down big, restraint is not a great fashionable concept. I don't think it ever was. Because I think we mix it up with constraint, Constraint is something that we live with a lot of the time. Our lives are very constrained in these highly complex societies. There's not a lot of space. Yeah. There's not a lot of time, not a lot of spare time. There's always a kind of next thing, busy, not a lot of physical space, not a lot of tolerance. We have to often have to act in ways that are quite specialized, and success and failure. You know, so there's quite a lot of pressure gets built up in modern life or in urban life. Or so we live under these constraints. You feel quite tense and tight trying to get it right all the time. So then we think restraint seems to just kind of tighten up a bit more. Doesn't sound such a good idea. Because most we're looking for something like release. You know, relax, release. This is much more attractive to my way. Relax, release, enjoy, rather than restrain. But the restraint is restraint in terms of coming back to restraint of the patterns, the reactions that keep fixing us and that act as limitations on our freedom. So we're restraining that in order to realize that which is relaxed, at ease, checking the things that tighten us up, wind us up, make us flare or make us sink. So the restraint then is something that actually helps to check the things that constrain us. Restraint is often like external qualities, such as restraint over what one puts someone's mind into, just being a bit more prudent about what we attend to, what we think about, what we read or look at. Restraint in what we requisites that we use, how much you really want or need, which is practice in its own right, because by and large the world in general is saying you need more, the newer, the better, the faster, the more powerful, exciting, and so forth. So just putting that word as a value word, rather than the more, the higher, the wilder. Just to kind of check the way that we get used by the commercial material world, because it's what it does. You know, it eats you up. We think we're eating it, but actually it's the other way around. Your time gets eaten up, your money gets eaten up, your energy gets eaten up, your heart gets eaten up by all this stuff. So just checking that. And then restraint in terms of what we want to bring forth, what we act, what we do. So there's obviously things like refraining from killing, harming, stealing, lying, abusing, verbally or sexually, abusing ourselves, intoxication, drugs, messing ourselves up. Amazing that people haven't really caught on to this yet, by and large. So. You know, that maybe if we just stop doing all this stuff, we wouldn't have to have so many forms of entertainment. You know, we'd feel good in ourselves. We just stop messing ourselves up. But it doesn't sell very bananas, that kind of line. So it's something you've actually got to keep kind of applying. Because our minds always can think of the better, the more advanced, the better. I mean, well, what about what we are, what we've got already? What's wrong with that? Is it? And will it, is there anything, you know, will the new thing be actually be better? Or just newer? Different. This is a very powerful habit. And this is monastery, we've been doing this with monasteries for 25 years or so in Britain. And, you know, it's to actually find that line where, you know, you actually do need to have a roof without holes in it. It's true. You need to get things, these things working. And yet there's a point at which you get into a habit of fixing and changing and improving things. And so the actual quality of the life gets lost because we're always busy thinking, figuring, planning, working things out. Actually, would it maybe be better if we just live with what the way it is? You know, it doesn't look so good, but it, you know, internally. So that quality of restraint helps to find the place where we could actually deepen and feel more quality in our life. Because you can see that the more we go out, actually, you know, it just keeps getting, the target goes up and up and up. The level of what would be good and happy is continually moving upwards. So you never get to the end of it. Thing of beauty is a joy for a fortnight. on a good, you know, if you're really, sometimes less than that, actually, a joy for an hour. So this is when you're using restraint, not from some puritanical, you know, tight fear of things, but just what's going to, you know, what gives in this world, you know, what is this world about, really? Where do you find the goods, the happiness, the fruitions? So this sense of moderation, and then enough, so you can actually let go of that and just turn inwardly. You've got more time, more space, more opportunities to develop the mind, the heart, attention, awareness, sensitivity, skills in terms of what we, you know, the energies of the mind, learning to calm, moderate that, brighten it, clear the doubts or the dullness, restlessness, irritation. So then restraint actually becomes the doorway that says, okay, this is change of direction, we move this way. To enter something where we could be free. Is something that you know, certainly I noticed in my own life over many years is as a monk coming up 30 years. I didn't come into this from some religious idea. I never didn't have a religious upbringing and didn't have any religious beliefs. But I knew what suffering, stress, confusion, wanting is about. You feel that. And so, like most people, you know, when you're youth, you move out and you start to explore lots of things. And what's the world about? You know, what's it got? What's on offer here? What's tasty? What's exciting? What's interesting? What's new? And after about five or six years of that, yeah, okay. And but then by the time I got to started travelling, by the time I got to Asia, I felt like a kind of an oversaturated sponge. You know, it was just too much stuff in my experience to process it, just dripping, sodden. There's no room for anything else. You know, sit down somewhere, and immediately the inner mind will just start babbling, you know, thinking, fantasizing, dreaming, wondering, wanting this, wanting that. It was kind of wall to wall full, crammed. You know, there was hardly any space to really receive anything anymore. So as I did the traveling, I'd find it would take less and less time. Like I'd go to somewhere, and within maybe, first of all, within a week, I get bored with it. Then it got to within 2 days. Then it got to within an hour. I'd already, you know, I couldn't take it in. It was like this strange sense of you look at something, you can't get it because you're already so full up, your senses are so full with the future, the past, and so forth. I just need to squeeze the sponge, you know, to, not because I, you know, out of some aversion, but just so I can to have some freshness in the mind. And that's really why I went to a monastery, a sense of chilling out a bit. Oh, to be glacial by now. It doesn't quite work like that. Yeah, I didn't go into deep freeze. But just being in a place where there really wasn't very much going on, then you know, it's a lot of external restraint. But still, that what that meant was that this turning inwards, you come into the incredible dimensions of memory and thought and emotions and wanting and not wanting and so forth going on all the time, futures and past, and should I be this, should I be that. So it was very full, and I mean, kind of not exactly squeezing the sponge, but letting it evaporate over these last 25-30 years, letting it just kind of evaporate. That's what it tends to do. No, actually, I don't particularly want anything very much. A bit of space, time. But then with that, one notices certain kind of fundamental, more fundamental hankerings, like I'd like to be peaceful forever. For the rest of my life, I'd like things not to happen. I'd like things to be stable, steady, not be bothered, not get wound up, not have to think, not have to do anything. I'd like to just, you know, like the future to be assured. I could probably manage gentle tides of adoration coming this way. Right, it's not too intense. I don't have to do anything back, you know, I'm getting a bit better at that. So that sense one wants the future, you know, to be okay, to be fine. I want what's around me to be okay and fine. I want to live in somewhere that's peaceful and happy and calm and bright. And that's actually the next level of restraint, because the mind sets up expectations and ideals and assumptions and scenarios of the way it should be. So when one starts to enter into the realm of mind, we see, first of all, if you like, there's the mental content, which you can, just by checking and stabilizing and getting into the present and feeling the distress of the passions or grudges or doubts, and you begin to use meditation to clean those out. But underneath that, one has the fundamental structure, not just the content, but the structure, if you like, call it structure. It means fundamental, you know, psychological structure, which means future, you know, what's around me. I want me to be good. I want what's around me to, for me to be good, there's got to be what's around me good, and there's got to be a future I'm moving towards. Happy little me. You know? That's the fundamental structure, you know, time and space, and I'm in it. And as I want it to be good, or at least not bother me. Hmm. And if that's just a little bit too much to ask for. Because I noticed this, and certainly in my own mind, and you know, trying to make things right, make things work, make things good, make things okay. And I see it in others around me. It's a good intention in many ways, you know. One doesn't want to make things bad anyway. But just checking the compulsion of that, actually, how much do I want to effort? It's almost like any other form of acquisition, you know, building, clothes. How much effort do I want to put into making it really good? Because the more I put into that, there's a certain loss of steadiness and calm and okayness in the present, isn't there? That's what you find with any kind of anything that you feed on, anything that you live with. That you know, there's a certain point which you actually need it to be good enough, and then beyond that, if you find you're starting to lose out because you're putting so much energy into making it better or right, that you lose the quality of freshness or brightness or appreciation. You know, it's like having the perfect garden or the perfect car or anything like that. There's got to be a sign in which it's good enough. And so similarly with the future, the present, the future, what's around is sort of good enough. Yeah. Is the restraint. Because in practicing Dhamma, we're not actually carving out a little oasis somewhere. You actually, it flows into the world, into our own personal world, into the physical world, into the culture that we're in. We're part of all that. So, and we always have to live with a certain amount of things not being the way one wants them to be. Feel comfortable with. And instead of the reactions and the the panic, the blaming, the guilt, the regret. So this is a kind of key point in the Buddha's teaching, actually recognizing the unsatisfactoriness of what manifests, even in the mind, is supposed to be a kind of a blessing. So you know, it doesn't actually get ultimately good. So then you can relax from that, or relax from those drives and expectations that are trying to make it the best. This is very important to recognize, because particularly when you pick up any sense of personal development or religious life or spiritual development, then the bar is very high. It's a big jump to get over. You want to be Buddha or peaceful or happy or whatever have you put it, then the sky's the limit, really. And so how do we deal with the mundane and the ordinary? This is what restraint is about. So just keeping the expectation, lower, right now. So it actually takes us back to the very qualities of Buddha. So we, you know, we like to think of Buddha as the, you know, something that's supreme, and this beautiful Buddha image. But the quality of Buddha is just, it just has none of the quality of being awake to the way things are. It's very much a, but that means that the restraint of that is that we normally see things not actually as they are, but how they impress us, or how they should be, or what they remind us of. So, you know, the specific quality of life is something the Buddhas know. Most of us know what things remind us of, what we fear things might be, what we hope things would be, what we assume other people think, the flavours and colours and innuendos and, you know, that are happening. The mind kind of goes into that and enlarges it, because it's seeking that, all that territory of the possible, and the to be fulfilling. Specific things only last, are just very momentary, and the mind feeds upon the resonances that it picks up from things, the memories, the impressions, the promises of pleasure, fulfillment, security. That's what comforts the normal mind. It's like this, therefore you can have a good time. It's like this, therefore things are going to be okay. It's like this. And it's always, it's like something. Something reminds us of. Somebody says something, and that's the way, they always like that. So it can be. It can also be that a lot of our pain comes from what things remind us of, not just the promises, but the pain. Someone says something, we hear. We hear something that represents something within us. It pushes a button. It reignites old karma. We see the present. We experience the present. And it touches into something of the past that rises up. It can be pleasant, of course, it can be pleasant. Unfortunately, that same mechanism delivers enormous voltage of pain. So, if we want to find a way out of the pain, there has to be a way of finding a way out of the pleasure, which doesn't sound like a winning ticket, find your way out of pleasure. But there's another kind of pleasure, which is the pleasure of lightness, just the momentary, of non-attachment, which is what restraint is about. And this is what Buddhas have perfected. You can imagine that the historical Buddha, living in India, living out on the countryside in India, probably life was very much substandard, I would imagine. No air conditioning, no special foods, minimal, just walking around, no cars, no transport, heat, flies, disease, whatever food poor people could give in India, which is not great news. Rag, robes, and often people being quite nasty to him, not living with waves of adoration continually breaking over him, probably maybe less than I get. But actually people being, some people trying to kill him. His cousin tried to kill him several times. My cousin's never done that to me. And yet the Buddha's living happily. He's not one walking around getting paranoid, wondering where the next meal is going to come from, wondering who's going to have a difficult, challenging meeting with this evening, you know, some grumpy ascetic who wants to do a number on him. You know, or some recalcitrant monk, some miscreant who's done some abomination that he's got to sort out. People complaining. And at the same time not worrying about, oh, where's this religion going to? Oh God, what have I started? I knew I should have shut up and not said anything. I was doing all right on my own. And I started this teaching thing, and now I've got this responsibility. Oh, goodness. No, you just seem to be able to live happily in that. And, you know, that's quite an inspiration, really, because you said the Buddha was taking on enormous responsibility in a very little comfort, but through the quality of just coming into the specific moment and not hanging on. Not having expectation, not you know, trying to make things work for the future, not even trying to you know, have a great mission. He just said, you walk around, and if somebody asks you, you can say what you know. He wasn't going around. In fact, you're not supposed to go around just teaching people. So the idea is not to set the world on fire, but actually to put out the fire, to refrain. And let that quality of gentleness and peacefulness be its own teaching. That one is living in that restraint with happiness and vitality and joy. Yeah, so one of the things to recollect perhaps every day, rather than what should I do today, is what could I stop doing today? Maybe not physically. What could I stop doing in my mind or my attitudes? What could I stop worrying? Or stop worrying about that one a little bit. You know, just go chip down the list of and see, you know, because you begin to, not just the particular content, but it's starting to challenge the attitudes that you have to have it all together, all sorted, all fixed. So life becomes a huge project. And I can say quite honestly that nothing I've ever planned has ever happened. Things have happened that have been similar to it, but nothing I've ever worried about has actually ever happened. It takes a while to remember that, to really see that. You can't know the future. And a number of things I've actually kind of psyched myself up for, you know, haven't actually been necessary. But the habit is there to be over-prepared. It's like you get yourself all kitted out with psychologically a huge amount of armament, and then you find you've actually got to walk on water, and it's actually getting in the way of being able to really handle life. Because actually it's more the case that the lighter we are, the less things rock us around, the less weight you're carrying, the less things rock you around. To practice the way of Buddha is to practice Dhamma, which means you're actually bringing that particular view, or that particular point, that particular way of being into what you are, you know, your thoughts, your speech, your actions, the Eightfold Path. One of the most telling or convincing presentations is meditation itself. And most of us, even though we keep trying to get out of this habit, find that, you know, the big struggle in meditation is over meditating. That is, we try to learn too much, bring too much in, do too much, make it work, control it, get quick results, be good at it. And that tension and willfulness and striving and struggling and doubt and coming from kind of basic lack of confidence, lack of trust, is the kind of bedrock of all the troubles we experience in meditation. So it becomes really ironic when people stagger out of a meditational thing, now I can take a break, you know. What was the meditation about then? You know? I can stop meditating and be more peaceful. Yeah, well, that says something, doesn't it? Admittedly, you know, often when we're meditating, we're dealing. We're actually coming into the place where we're complicated. But then we don't actually need to be more complicated. The idea is to just the simple, what mindfulness is, just moment at a time, specifically noticing, not creating a lot, specifically just noticing, feeling in the body, without the reactions, without the assumptions, without the storyline, thoughts in the mind, emotions in the heart, without the additions to it, the complexities, the self-descriptions, the descriptions of others. Well, this is what aversion is, or doubt, like this, and experiencing it. So you really get more fully aware of a specific experience and drop the interpretations. That is a skill. That's the skill of mindfulness, which we develop in meditation. So what occurs in that, where there isn't that proliferation, there's a quality of space, openness, emptiness. And you begin to sense that, even though this is not so good, you know, the specific moment is, you know, could be better, isn't very good, is mediocre. The less I try to make it another way, the more is the ability to feel, sense, space, awareness itself. Certainly one of the big challenges of retreats and solitude and silence is you go out there with your little candle and your stick of incense and your Buddha image and your resolutions to, you know, enter the deathless and so forth. Right, here we go, you know, the big push. Sit there and your mind just starts babbling about some, you know, mediocrity. Not even passionate anymore, just kind of little dribbly thoughts. Who wrote Wuthering Heights, you know. What was the Doris Day's five greatest hits? And you know, this is hardly kind of hand to hand wrestling with the, you know, cosmic forces that one was expecting. So sometimes even one's defilements let one down. It's not having the grandeur or the tragic quality that will make it practice seem more significant. But often life is like that. It's dealing with these, is, you know, that's the specific quality of this. Because it's not in that it doesn't have to be that bad either. All that good. It's the ability to let it alone. That's a very profound training. That's restraint. Just letting it alone. Letting it do it, be itself. Now first, when you think that through, you probably think, oh, that means it will just kind of, everything will go and run wild and be complete But actually, if you really develop and enhance letting it alone, you remove the tendencies that keep things going, and the mind empties out. And it is a subtle and a very astute practice, because it's, you know, in the not leaving alone that I exist. That's where I get built up in my plots and my profile and my life story and my, you know, good, bad, whatever. The restraint is, in meditation, is the development of leaving things alone. One of the ways in which the early Sangha was always described, this is what people marvelled at, was that these summoners, these recluses, would be living under trees and sleeping on bits of straw, and they say their countenance was bright, clearly rejoicing. They were very alive. And feeding on nothing. I mean, obviously they were eating food, but actually the senses were not feeding on anything. And so you think, if people couldn't get this, like, how come, you know, you're not delighting in anything that's seen or heard or touched or tasted or thought? You're not delighting in any of these things, and yet you're delighting. Yeah. This is what was kind of attractive to people, because you begin to see that if you delight in things that are seen, touched, taste, felt, because those things change, you've got to have another one, another one, another one. That's how it begins, isn't it? That's how it happens. But then you say, okay, you don't delight in these, so that means you're miserable. No. They're feeding on nothing. It doesn't mean not feeding, but actually feeding on the emptiness, or the signless. Things, when our appetites are quelled, when our expectations drop, when our assumptions and interpretations take rest, everything speaks. Finally, instead of me trying to get it, everything speaks. And that's the delight, the silence speaks. Awareness speaks, it doesn't say anything. That you feel the quality of presence is tremendously satisfying. And the degree to which any of us realize this in our moments of our practice, when something finally relaxes, lets go, is of course enormously nourishing. But also just to remember, this is the image of Sangha. This is, if you like, the icon of Sangha, is the delight, the fulfillment through not feeding. This is a kind of possibility. This is what it means for an arahant, to the enlightened one. Or nothing that's seen, heard, touched, tasted, imagined, conceived, planned, projected, prepared for, dreaded, remembered, interpreted, because the mind is the greediest of the lot. And this is, to my mind, this is just a wonderful possibility. Every day when we go for the alms round in the house, there's a little sign. One of our supporters did this beautiful needlework of a few lines of scripture, and it says, "Free from possessiveness, one holds nothing and rejects nothing." And I always have to stand there every day, these few moments that the rest of the Sangha come in, before I go for the alms round. It's a really nice daily seeing the teacher. Every day I see the teacher. The teacher sits there. And this is what he says every day. And every day I think, oh yeah, that's it. And I get in the kitchen. Oh, yeah, some of that. I'm rejecting nothing. Okay, tomorrow. Yeah. But it does get in there over the years. But it's sometimes we feel that restraint is really primarily external, but the internal is the important one. Restraining the mind, then the others fall into place once one begins to relax that demand to be something. Or to be nothing, things begin to quieten, and we can feel the fulfillment of a spacious, empty mind. This is the highest restraint, brings the highest blessing.
Amen.